Suppose cephalosporin-resistant gonorrhea has landed. Now what do you do?
Well, this is an act in progress here. This is sort of a division activity, and have people from really across the branches wrestling with this, and with our program and laboratory colleagues answer this question. You know, you've heard actually about the near and present concern in this very last presentation about the real possibility that there are organisms that are not necessarily going to roll over and play dead when we wave our recommended treatment in front of them. So where do we go? Where are we going? And there's a series of questions, and some of which have been answered more or less, I think, over the course of this conference. One, why should we be concerned? Why do we want to know? What are our responses given, you know, the presence of such an organism? And how would we know, given our public health infrastructure, when a worrisome, quote-unquote, strain's present? And what is a worrisome strain? What the heck are we actually looking for? And what can the health departments do to facilitate the prompt identification of the presence of such a strain? What are the implications for treatment? What else needs to be done? Now, to begin that kind of, begin answering some of those, we had a reasonably short consultation in September of this past year, participants from programs, from labs, and from a bunch of us at CDC and folks from the Department of Defense, with a focus on bringing together people who would be at the front lines of locales where we'd be expected to see such an organism land first. Now, again, why the concern? Well, you've heard some of the concern. Internationally, there have been treatment failures with cephalosporins and associated increases in MICs. I would mention, we try to actually put two talks together for this thing. One, to have a discussion about this whole issue really in depth, and another one about the response. We only got one of them, so I'm sort of trying to cram two talks into one. And so, talking twice as fast as I usually do. Keep in mind, U.S. has not been spared the appearance of resistant organisms that have shown up elsewhere. That example you've heard about fluoroquinolone's case in point. It may not have landed the same time it landed elsewhere, but it got here by and by and spread through the population to the extent that, as you heard, by 2007, we changed the recommendations to say that it shouldn't be frontline drug for anybody in the U.S. And then, this is the bottom line, no reason to doubt that if resistance is occurring elsewhere, that it won't appear here. You just really don't know when. And then, you know, as you've heard, we're using the only drugs we really have, third generation cephalosporins, and then no obvious new drugs in the pipeline to count on. This is some of the data that have gotten people like Ron Ballard sort of all hot and bothered about the possibility of a bad drug showing up. Hong Kong, you see some of the data, which I won't go through in great depth, but cephalosporin resistance. I want to point out, our measures, we have called alert values, ceftriaxone at 0.5 micrograms, ceftriaxone at half of that, at the same thing, 0.5. Cefpidoxime we use as 1.0 micrograms. So just have some sense of what these numbers mean. Showed up in Japan with a worrisome bug. Australia has seen the MICs to ceftriaxone drift upward over time. And I don't like where the oval is. So that's what's distracting me here. This is some results out of Taiwan. They used the disc diffusion technique, not the agar dilution, so the numbers were a little off. But the point is that they're seeing treatment failures, and they're seeing cefpidoxime resistance. And probably the most worrisome data came out of Japan that is reasonably thorough in how they look at the data. And you see what's happened from over 10 years overall, I guess from 1999 to 2002. Ceftriaxone in particular goes from zero to over to almost 30% of the isolates have what we would call, you know, decreased susceptibility. That's a pretty big kind of jump with some move in ceftriaxone, but nowhere as much. This was getting at one of the main issues that Ron Ballard keeps harping at, is that you may very well see problems and resistance to the oral cephalosporins, but not to ceftriaxone. And that's actually a pattern that hopefully holds, but we've seen it so far. Now, in terms of responses to some of these findings, this was results of a survey that John Tapsell had done, sort of calling around the Western Pacific region, looking at what's being used. You see, Japan has now gotten so upset with the performance of their drugs, they are treating, you see in the first column, they're using ceftriaxone at 1 gram IV. That's their treatment for gonorrhea. China is using 250 IM of ceftriaxone, and only ceftriaxone, when it's proprietary, meaning it's Rocephin, when they have to rely on their own homegrown brew, they're up to a 1 gram IM. So this is where, this is the responses that are taking place, you know, throughout the Western Basin. And you see, the center column, not a whole lot of suffixing being used. Now, I'm not sure whether Ron Ballard has gotten the message to them or he got the message from them. Either way, ain't a lot of oral cephalosporins being used throughout that region. Some of the data that we've had, basically, you can see in cefixime, the more recent measure of cefixime is that little red bar on the right, creeping up a little bit. Not a whole lot in the higher end, but some suggestion of some change. These are 2009 data, just to see where we are in the United States. Ceftriaxone, none this past 2000. And there's about 6,000 isolates a year, so you have an idea about it. It's a pretty rare thing. No isolates that show decreased susceptibility to ceftriaxone. 2 out of 6,000 show a decreased susceptibility to cefixime, but you're seeing more to cefpidoxy, you know, at that cutoff. Now, I have to say, these cutoffs, people have emphasized, we don't exactly know what they mean. You know, there's not a good hard piece of evidence that says you have this level of this MIC, this means resistance. So we use this funny term, decreased susceptibility, whatever that means. But you'd rather see it on the low end rather than creep up the high end, is the bottom line. So looking at the trajectory of what's happened in the United States, as people have pointed out, this was we had in a paper in the Annals a couple of years ago. You know, in 1989, penicillin no longer was recommended because of what? Because of PPNG and other forms of resistance. In short order, ceftriaxone, which had the Cipro, had been recommended, and ceftriaxone. But then, 2002, 2004, 2007, fluoroquinolones no longer recommended. Now, just a sort of sense of what are the possibilities in terms of interrupting spread. This was back, I dug out of 1986, Louisiana tackles PPNG. And they stated, you know, this was not exceptional. No, but this was the approach in a lot of states. The state health department laboratory is currently testing all positive cultures for resistant gonorrhea strains. Pretty impressive. Also, contact activities, you know, in-depth interview and contact tracing for everybody. Okay. Now, you see at the bottom, this was David Martin calling to arms the assault on PPNG. You see how that worked out. You know, continued increase around the country, so that 1989 we had to abandon the use of penicillin. So some of the folks have taken to heart how well these public health approaches would work in interrupting the spread and the establishment of resistant strain. So the first question at the consultation, we were sort of saying, what kind of response will we be mustering, do you want to recommend mustering, given the appearance of a worrisome bug? Do we think about containment, you know, or mitigation, you know? Well, based on the past history, and particularly the PPNG perspective, people decided it's really not feasible to try to contain the spread. The circumstances are all less favorable than at that point in time. Lack of culture and lack of antimicrobial sensitivity testing and limited resources for partner services. So the focus, people decided, is on mitigation. What that means is to assure the provision of highly effective treatment to patients with gonorrhea and their partners, along with a reasonable, i.e. modest, attempt to slow dissemination. But what that does, that requires a reasonably prompt identification of the presence of the organism so that you get your treatment recommendations right. So how do you know if a worrisome strain is present? What are the tools you have at your disposal? Well, one, if you have a GISP clinic. Now, I've got to tell you, GISP is not the be-all, end-all in terms of that kind of information. I'll mention briefly the pros and cons. GISP 1986, a sentinel event that tracks antimicrobial susceptibilities to gonorrhea. And you see it's across the country, but it's not everywhere across the country. You know, 29 sites and not 3,000 counties, you know. So GISP clinics are not everywhere. The other thing, this is sort of all the steps that go through, specimens are here, they're sent to there, they're tested, and by the results get back and compiled and sent out. Well, what's the bottom line? The bottom line is that there's at least a lag of 2 to 3 months between the clinic visit and having those results available that promptly identify new cases of emerging antimicrobial resistance. So there is a timeliness issue that may not really be acceptable in terms of using this as a public health sentinel event to tell you when you should be changing, you know, policies, or at least to flag the presence of the bug. So less than timely. But it may not be the only source of antimicrobial sensitivity data in your community. This was kind of data we used to pull together in our reports. These are non-GISP data that are available, but we've stopped collecting those. We've collected, but they haven't stopped testing. So the point is that across the country, there are other labs doing this testing, and part of the consultation was saying, hey, you have to get out there and beat the bushes and see what are the other sources of information that you can use to tell you what's happening in your community. Okay? Well, so there's GISP, there's other labs, but probably what would be useful in most circumstances is evaluation of treatment failures, really putative treatment failures. And that may be the principal way to know whether you have a bad bug that's arrived. Now, this is not a simple thing. The circumstances from the mid-1980s have changed. So, one, you need to be making providers aware of the need for and being prepared to obtain culture given a treatment failure. It's nothing that providers are prepared to do at this point. That provider also needs to know what the heck to do with that specimen he's taking, which is the laboratory that you can send it to get that gonorrhea culture performed. And then those cultures need to be tested for susceptibility. Well, okay, how do you get them there? Which is the lab that's going to be able to perform according to protocol that antimicrobial susceptibility testing? All of those steps are going to have to be worked out by the health department in advanced planning, working with partners, working with their colleagues, and lab folks and others here can help identify the appropriate labs, but it's going to take a lot of this work on the ground and sort of laid out all the partners, all the steps that's going to be required. It's not a trivial undertaking. Another approach could use possibly surveillance data to tell you if something is going on by flagging individuals with repeat GC positive results less than 30 days apart. You usually dismiss those as issues of duplication, but this may be a flag. I haven't looked at that yet, but it was an idea that came up. So what exactly is this kind of worrisome strain thing? We don't know what to call it. I think we're still debating what to term this thing. You know, it's not a superbug, you know, but what to call it and what to have as the case definition and what to have people report and what are the steps to take is still under discussion. Well, it's tricky. We haven't solved it yet. And as I pointed out, there's no hard MIC definition of what resistance is with regard to third-generation cephalosporins. And, you know, that may be differences as you move from drug to drug. And we still have yet to reach full agreement with all the partners about what should be reportable and what should be actionable. There may be a, you know, a difference between reportable and actionable. Alert values, we pointed out, you know, have not really been anointed by the anointing organization, the CLSI, and not necessarily tightly correlated with clinical treatment failure. Well, these are the numbers that I mentioned, the ceftriaxone equal or greater than 0.5, same thing for cefixime, cefpodoxime. That's what we use as alert values. Now, it turns out fortuitously that some of the data from Japan suggests that treatment failures may actually be correlated with that 0.5 microgram level of cefixime. And the good thing is that we really haven't documented real resistance to ceftriaxone, and MIC is almost every place over 0.125 micrograms, really pretty rare. So we may be able to reach agreement on what to be collecting, what to be looking for, what to be reporting, and what to be jumping on. But again, these are the tricky operational steps that all need to take place, heightening awareness, identifying, focusing primarily on those providers that treat gonorrhea frequently and being sure they are appropriately resourced. And we have to make explicit, what the heck is a treatment failure? Well, in the absence of test of cure, and right now we are not recommending a test of cure, so you're basically going to have to rely on those individuals who continue to be symptomatic or have the reappearance, prompt reappearance of symptoms in the absence of sexual exposure following treatment with the recommended third generation cephalosporin. And then have that specimen and then have an MIC of one level or above. So you need to be encouraging your providers to obtain the specimen for culture in those circumstances. Now, that's not a simple thing. Those of us that have tried to get providers, worse than the herding cats exercise, right? And to have available a means to culture that individual and have it transported, something like Transgrow. But that has to be an everybody shelf, not something that you call up because the patient is there, symptomatic. They will be retreated with something else. So you lose that opportunity to get the specimen the next day. It's got to be there at the moment of presentation. Treatment implications. So again, no clear evidence of resistance to ceftriaxone. That's very important. And so thinking about the language that we probably have in the treatment guidelines that will be coming out later, hopefully by the summer, you don't like to be sure, you know, that language sometimes changes between here and there, but probably recommending ceftriaxone 250 milligrams. And the primary concern, you know, we've gotten the word, Ron. The area of concern is emergence of resistance to oral cephalosporins. And we're looking to use the language to encourage the use of ceftriaxone, but you really can't insist on it. There are too many circumstances, it's just not feasible. Cefpidoxime is, through subtle use of language, discouraged. Dual treatment for gonorrhea, we won't be probably including opt-out provisions. The previous language had said if you are negative on a chlamydia test, you do not have to. We won't say, you know, what you do, we don't have to. We just would probably remove that opt-out language. And there are limited data that suggest that dual treatment with azithromycin may enhance treatment efficacy, particularly for pharyngeal infection when using the oral cephalosporins. And I would say this, there's been some discussion about this topic. We do not see this as having implications for EPT, okay? Because remember, the EPT guidance says that EPT is used when it's unlikely that partners would otherwise present for treatment. And so if they weren't going to come in for treatment, you're far better off getting them treated with an effective oral cephalosporin than no treatment at all, right? If you can get them in, get them in. But this is for people who are not going to be coming in. Okay? Why do you have the ceftriaxone? Well, you know, we're having our fingers crossed that we won't need something after ceftriaxone, but just to sort of say, and Debbie Dowell is the principal investigator on this, we're conducting a randomized trial in collaboration with NIH's clinical trial group, looking at other treatment possibilities. And it's not a comparative trial, it's looking at two different limbs, one with an oral and another with a parenteral kind of delivery. Regimen A, gentamicin, 240 milligrams IM, plus azithro at 2 grams, and the other limb gets, is the oral, gemifloxacin, 320, plus azithro at 2 grams. And want, hopefully, to have treatment regimens in the bank to have, should we need it, to have fair evidence that meet the CDC criteria for recommendation, which is clinical efficacy at least of 95% and a lower 95% CI bound of at least 90. So that's where we're at. What's next? Well, we need to really clarify that case definition, particularly with regard to the MICs, and clarify exactly what are the steps to do. You know, you haven't nailed that down. Obviously, you need to assess and treat the partner and the individual, and particularly with ceftriaxone, if they have a treatment failure and they have a bad bug, and send the report and ask the CDC. CDC will be doing some more work and developing some guidance for labs and maybe for provider training. You need to monitor results locally, develop non-culture techniques. This is the sort of thing that Penn was talking about, that this may be a way to get a handle on what's going on in the community, molecular approaches to identify worrisome bugs. But not agreed upon yet is what happens once you identify that bug, how local authorities, what they can do to determine what community prevalence is, and whether community prevalence warrants changing those policies or not. Finding one bug that's a little worrisome does not necessarily mean that you want to throw over the cards and call out the fire department. You know, how do you actually get a handle on whether it's 1 in 1,000 or 5 in 100? It makes a very big difference. So that's not been worked out, that operational step. That's it.
Thanks very much. We can take questions for Dr. Berman or for any of the speakers at this time.
I have two quick questions. One, that data you showed from Japan, it looked like it was a little bit older from published data. Are there more up-to-date data just from your contact with him? Is that trend continuing? Or?
Well, I think the trend is continuing. You may want to touch base. Ron has been in close communication with WHO. They're trying to gather more data. Try to list only those published data, but the data are continuing to accumulate. Ron, do you have more to add? Or?
Only that you did show that the recommended treatment now is 1 gram of ceftriaxone intravenously, and so they're putting out all the fires associated with using inappropriate oral KEFs and KEFMs in the past. But once again, you know, there is still continued use of some of these drugs, but. In essence, they're trying to put the lid on it by using this huge dose of ceftriaxone.
Well, I was more what the implication for us is, still, but I got you. Yeah.
Well, the implication for us is very simple. These things are going to come across the Pacific, just like ciprofloxacin resistance.
Yes.
But the point is, we've got to preempt that. That's the point.
My second question relates to that same point. Since you're going to come across, you talked about the delay in GISP, and is there something we could do to add a little surge capacity, get caught up with that testing or something, and get the GISP results faster back to our clinics? We're trying to interview cases in a timely fashion, interview their partners in a timely fashion, get some cultures done maybe on the partners or whatnot. It seems like a important time in our sort of history, just to try and do it more quickly if possible.
Yeah. Let me put in mind, GISP was never set up to be part of the clinical management structure. It would change, it's struggling to hang on now to have it funded, so you'd have to change a lot of the mechanics of it.
I didn't mean for individual clinical management, but for the implications of what's going on in those communities, it seems like it'd be ideal to do it a little bit more quickly if possible.
Well, obviously, whether you have it 3 months or 2 months, you know, you have to, the point is that it's not useful for that patient, a few patients.
Yeah.
Over time, it is critical. It's the way we make decisions. But keep in mind, it is more for national kind of trends rather than directing communities to know what's happening. Are the drugs they are using appropriate for the circumstances? You may certainly have a county here and someplace there where you have 3, 4, 5, 6% prevalence of a bad bug that they're 1,000 miles away from a GISP clinic and wouldn't know. It's for a limited number of places. So over time, we'll know whether it gets on a broader basis. But more importantly than relying on GISP in those 29 sites is for every community to have in place a way to know whether they are being hit or not. And GISP is just a few spots on that map for those local communities.
Stu, thanks very much for putting this problem in perspective for us. Has there been any discussion at CDC about the carbapenems, in particular ertapenem? The STICTG actually had a protocol thinking or addressing that issue, and it was dropped, I think, because the company didn't want to pursue it. But if we need it, I don't know whether whether David has tested, you guys in the labs have tested the ertapenem at all?
Well, we were thinking through all the possible drugs and the combinations, and that was, you know, actually Kim Wachowski was leading that discussion.
Right.
And there was an issue of cost and what made sense broadly. And so, you know, that was one of the reasons we went to something that was readily available, would be reasonably priced, and didn't stop at the...
I would think it would be worthwhile at least testing some of the series of the GIF strains against the carbapenems just to have some knowledge about what the activity levels would be.
Right.
Hannon Berry from San Francisco. I just want to, one of your last slides, you discussed use of NAT tests for a test of cure, and that's something we've been talking a lot about because I think there's very little data on how to do that and particularly what timing to use for that. I think expert opinion says wait 3 weeks after treatment, but you know that then reduces, you know, then you're asking patients to be abstinent for 3 weeks and present some other problems. So I guess I wondered if CDC had any other movement or any other studies were planned on that.
That would be a huge problem, right, to implement and say every place now you have to be doing test of cure. The time to clearance is the least of the problems, you know, that we can say now coming like 21 days or, you know, you say now 21 days after your treatment is completed. But to actually say that everybody needs to be coming back, and it would be hell, wouldn't it? That's in case you have lose. You know, one of the good things about thinking you had a treatment that was broadly effective against at least 95% of gonorrhea meant that you were spared that kind of recommendation. At the point in which you no longer think you're meeting that standard, and you need to be identifying those who are failing it, you'd have to go to that, and you'd probably pick your places. But it would be a recommendation of last resort for sort of broader implementation.
I'd like to thank Stu and all the speakers.